I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer, reporting from Ford Island at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Pacific Aviation Museum on Ford Island is a showcase of aviation history from biplanes to modern jet fighters. Aircraft from World War II through the Vietnam War era are housed in old military hangars, some still showing machine gun bullet hole scars from the December 7, 1941 Japanese aircraft attacks. In addition to an array of U.S. fighters and bombers, there's also an incredibly restored Japanese Mitsubishi fighter on display. The museum also features historic civil aviation ephemera, including Pan American, United, and American Airlines that have had a long historic association with the Hawaiian Islands. Located just steps from the USS Arizona Memorial and the USS Missouri Battleship, numerous Pearl Harbor 75th Anniversary Remembrance events are scheduled to take place at the museum during the first 2 weeks in December. Come along and join Kenneth DeHoff, the executive director, followed by an insightful walking tour with Burl Burlingame, Pacific Aviation Museum's historian. We're here with Kenneth DeHoff, the executive director of the Pacific Aviation Museum. Kenneth, what a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much for coming to visit us. It's a real honor to be able to share with you what we're doing here in the middle of Pearl Harbor.
And you were a naval captain or army captain?
I'm an army captain.
And you were airborne?
I jumped out of airplanes, but mainly I flew Cobra helicopters. And so I have a little aviation background.
Mm-hmm. How did you wind up going from army aviation to here as executive director? That's fascinating.
Well, I broke my back in Vietnam, and they triaged me out. They actually told me I'd never walk again. The doctors at Fitzsimmons put me back together, and after a couple of years, got me back up on my feet. And
did you crash in the Hilo? What? How did you?
Yeah, I was shot down, and it was kind of a fiery crash, and that was 45 years ago.
Probably feels like yesterday in some ways, huh?
A lot of it is. Particularly, we just had Colonel Bill Reeder here. Bill just wrote a new book, Through the Valley. And he had a helicopter crash also, similar to mine, about a year later. And he was captured and was forced march from South Vietnam to Hanoi.
Wow.
And he just was here signing his book, and we were telling stories. And so when those things happen, it brings it to mind again. It makes you stop and think. I do 100 push-ups and sit-ups every day, and just thank God that we're still able to do that.
And how old are you now?
How old am I now? Yeah. I think I turned 69.
Very impressive.
But now I grew up in Arizona and Utah, and then went to Colorado to University of Denver. And so I've got the Arizona on one side of me and the USS Utah on the other side of me. So it's almost like being at home. And yet, here we are on an airfield that was actually built in 1917. This was originally called Luke Field, one of the first Army airfields. And you had a chance to take a look at the grass field that's out there. Can you imagine 200 airplanes on that back when people like General Claire Chennault was a captain here in 1926? And then you fast forward 10 years and Amelia Earhart landed her Lockheed Electra here. And she was going around the world from east to west. This was her first stop. She was taken off downwind, probably overloaded, and the airplane ground looped and the front main gear collapsed, wrecked the airplane, and she packed it up and sent it back to Oakland. But that was March 1937. At the same time, Pan Am was landing the Clippers here. Those early Clippers, those were the Martins and the
before the Boeing.
Yeah, before the Boeing 314. And they landed out here in the middle lock and floated over to Pearl City Peninsula and unloaded passengers. And then all the maintenance was done here on Ford Island.
Very interesting.
Let's fast forward to 1941 was the attack here in Pearl Harbor. And so the hangars that we're in actually survived that bombing and strafing. And so one of our challenges is to be the steward of these historic hangars and for us to conserve them, restore them, and then tell their stories. Hangar 6 actually burnt to the ground by a bomb that was dropped in the wrong place. So 1941 is very much a watermark for the museum, and we tell a lot of stories about the activities that are going on. December 7th itself here in Pearl Harbor is a commemoration, and every year we work with the Navy and the National Park Service, the USS Missouri, and the Bofin submarine, what we call the Pearl Harbor Historic Sites Partnership, to put on a program that honors those that were here on December 7th, 1941, along with the Navy, who puts a ship out and floats that ship by with all the sailors standing at the rail. And we have an opportunity to take a moment and reflect what happened on that day. And so I think the December 7th event for me is the most powerful. Parallel to that, the museum has been open for 10 years now. And this will be our 10th anniversary. And every Saturday night before December 7th, we have a huge party. This year, we'll have about 900 people in Hangar 79, and it's a fundraising event, and we'll have a lot of different activities going on. One of those activities is around the B-17 Swamp Ghost that we have. We're working with Disney to build an Imaginarium exhibit around that.
And how would that work?
That is a wonderful relationship. First of all, Disney, during World War II, did about 1,000 nose arts for airplanes, pretty much around their cartoon characters. We asked them to help us with the B-17 that we brought back from New Guinea. And they painted up Donald Duck coming out of the swamp and call it the Swamp Ghost. We're building an exhibit that will be much like a Disneyland ride, where you'll have some anticipation before you get in close to the airplane. And then as you get close to the airplane, you'll be able to see what it was like flying before it got to Rabaul as it took off from Townsville. Then you'll finally get in to see the aircraft in the swamp, and you'll get to see the crew get out and return to Australia and continue the fight. And so that'll be a dramatic exhibit, and we're really, really happy to be working with Disney on that.
When the Pacific Aviation Museum was formed, what was the mission? What was the philosophy? What did you guys want to achieve?
Well, here you are in the middle of Pearl Harbor, and most people think of it in terms of the Arizona ship. But World War II was an aviation war. It had more airplanes in the sky than we had in all the world during the war. When you take a look at how many airplanes were built, we talked about the B-17 a minute ago. There was over 12,000 B-17s that were built. P-51s, P-38s, P-40s are common airplanes that we hear about or that we see at air shows. And yet there were over 100,000 warbirds, fighter aircraft that were built to win that war. And the Pacific Aviation Museum is about telling those stories of not just an airplane, but the heroes that flew them, the conflicts or battles that they were in, and to marry that together with the airplane as an artifact, and the story then can be told that has just tremendous, I'll just call it history, to it. And so that's the mission of the museum, is to make sure that we tell those stories of the pilot, their crews, or support personnel. We're working with the 475th Fighter Group who flew in the Pacific. They were a group that were formed by General Kinney to fly the P-38. And we were just looking at some exhibits that they have that we're going to move to Hawaii. And one of the exhibits they have is from Cookies, the cooks that cooked in tents and served meals, because these guys lived in tents and they were out in the rain, they were maintaining their airplanes on dirt fields. Those are stories that we're excited about telling.
And then there's that other dimension that I was bluntly very surprised to discover here, even walking in the front door, in your whole showcase of civilian aviation history, Pan American, for example.
The civil aviation and the commercial aviation came about in the 20s and 30s. And when you think about your first airplane ride across the United States, those were done in propeller airplanes, most likely in something like the DC-3. Those airplanes are part of our history also. And we tell the story of Pan Am and their Clippers. We tell the story of Hawaiian Airlines here. And we tell the story of American Airlines and United Airlines as because very few people come to Hawaii any longer in ships. Most of them fly here. And so those are all important stories that we share. And we're grateful to have those airlines as partners with the museum, too.
That's so great.
One of the main missions of a museum in telling the story is to make sure that you tell the story fairly, that you can get into talking about whether wars are right or wrong, or you can talk about those people that served in those wars and how they did their job, whether we're talking about Americans or Japanese or Germans or English or Australians. They all had heroes. They all had people that did their job, did what their nation called them to do. And those are stories that are important to share without bias, to make sure that being an international aviation museum, we have visitors from around the world to come. And we tell the story, and yet we try to leave that message with visitors that a world is a better place in peace. That's how we'd like to encourage people, and when they leave, to think about what we can all do to maintain peace in the world.
Kenneth DeHoff, thank you so much for sharing.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for coming.
It's my honor. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, where we've been visiting with Kenneth DeHoff, the Executive Director of the Pacific Aviation Museum at Pearl Harbor. Come along and join Burl Burlingame for a walking tour of Pacific Aviation Museum.
We're basically at the cradle of aviation for Hawaii. Pearl Harbor also became the central point for Pan Am flying in and out of the islands. The harbor was here. They could land at Pearl Harbor. They could land almost anywhere in any of the locks and then taxi to the Pan Am base. But the big flying boats that the Navy used flew right up through the late 1950s along what they call Lagoon Drive, which is we're in the front lobby at the Pacific Aviation Museum at Pearl Harbor, and we're surrounded by a big group of tourists, and they all arrived here by airplane. So it's not ironic, but it's fitting. Front lobby's got a great big map of Pearl Harbor on the floor, including Ford Island. But at the same time, if you want to know what Hawaii was like during World War II, go on any military base. There are things that haven't changed at all.
Example would be barracks.
The barracks, still some damage from the Pearl Harbor attack. And we're coming up on the 75th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack, which is one of those, you know, major commemorations that come around. Well, we're in the Hangar 37. We've walked into the main part of the hangar, and this was a maintenance building. It was here during the attack. Here we have a yellow biplane called a Stearman.
That was primary trainer, correct?
Primary trainer, a basic trainer. This one is interesting because one of the pilots that soloed on it was a young Navy pilot named George Herbert Walker Bush. He, at the time, he was the youngest pilot in the U.S. Navy. He soloed on this actual airplane. This building basically focuses on the Pearl Harbor attack up through the occupation of Guadalcanal by Allied troops. We have a F-4F-3 Wildcat, an SBD Dauntless, a B-25 Mitchell, a P-40E Warhawk, an Araka 65 TC, and an A-6M Japanese Zero, all in this building. We actually have two Zeros. One is the remains of one that crashed just after the Pearl Harbor attack.
On the island?
On the island of Niihau, which is one of the neighbor islands here in Hawaii. See the wreckage of it right over here. There's not much left because over the years, the Hawaiian cowboys cut out pieces and polished up the aluminum and decorated their saddles with it.
And the Billy Mitchell here.
This is the Billy Mitchell predicted that Pearl Harbor would be attacked on a Sunday morning, 20 years before it happened. And when we get into the Doolittle raid, we have a bomber called the B-25 Mitchell. It's still the only airplane in the American arsenal named after a human being.
Interesting.
And it became quite an airplane. My father was in the Air Force during World War II. He was a fighter pilot, but he also enjoyed flying the B-25. He said it was a wonderful airplane.
Over here to your right, a little more on this aircraft.
This is an SBD Dauntless. It's a workhorse. It's one of those planes that was flying on the first day of the war and on the last day of the war.
Wow.
Technically obsolete at the beginning of the war, but it's a solid piece of engineering. I mean, you can see all the rivets all over it. And you see it's a bit faded and the paint is faded, but it looks still pretty good. This is directly out of Lake Michigan.
Wow.
It's not been repainted. If you want to store an airplane for a long time, just put it at the bottom of Lake Michigan. It's cold, fresh, dark water. When it came up, it even had air in one of the tires.
Wow.
And this is the plane that won the Battle of Midway. McCluskey and Besk managed to see the Japanese carriers split their forces and sank three Japanese carriers in 7 minutes. We actually have a film crew here shooting right now, and we often have film crews in here because We've got things you can't see anywhere else in the world. Japanese Zeros, SPD Dauntlesses. It's also very colorful.
Crew, this is for a movie?
This was for a feature film called Under the Blood Red Sun, which is a well-known young adult novel. They're doing a re-premiere of it. Came out actually last year. And they're filming a new introduction with the author. We got a little bit of Hollywood going on here. We're at a historic site, you know, and there was tragedy here, you know, during the Pearl Harbor attack. Only one person was killed on Ford Island, a guy named Ted Croft, and he was killed almost immediately when bombs hit Hangar 6. And the tragic thing is he was getting out of the Navy the next day.
Wow.
He'd done his 20 years. But all the other people that died on Ford Island came ashore from the ships. Mm-hmm. See, one of the things we have to stress is that the Japanese never attacked Pearl Harbor. They attacked the American ships and airplanes that happened to be at Pearl Harbor. And so there's actually very little damage to the base itself, but the damage was really confined to the airplanes and the ships. And when you see damage, it's basically overshoots from when they were shooting at other things. And the only civilians targeted by the Japanese were civilian aircraft that were up in the air. The orange airplane we have hanging here is an Araka 65. It's an actual survivor of the Pearl Harbor attack. A guy named Batusik and his son were up in the air flying it. There were 8 civilian airplanes in the air that day. They flew right into the middle of the attack. They got shot up a bit, but managed to get away. But 4 of the civilian airplanes were shot down, and the people on them were killed.
Why did they want to take out the civilian aircraft?
Even a little light airplane like that could follow the Japanese back towards the fleet and give an Americans an idea what direction the fleet lay in. Radar was very crude back then. We really didn't understand how it worked. When the guys at North Shore picked up the Japanese coming in, they happened to be paralleling a flight of B-17s from the mainland, and they told their boss, that it's coming. He said, don't worry about it. But even if he had worried about it, he had no way of contacting the airfields. The phone lines hadn't been installed yet.
Oh, my God.
He would have had to drive out to the base and say something's up.
About what time in the morning was that, the radar base, guys?
It was around 7 o'clock.
So it would have been too late anyway.
And we'd already had a destroyer, had an encounter with a Japanese submarine just off of Pearl Harbor. The strange thing about the Pearl Harbor attack is that there was an American victory, actually, at Pearl Harbor, because the Japanese had equal weights of aircraft and submarines here. I mean, about 48% of the whole Japanese submarine fleet was around Oahu. And the idea was the planes would hit Pearl Harbor, you know, force the ships out of the harbors, and then the submarines would sink them. But we'd been really focused on anti-submarine warfare because we figured if war came, what would show up would be submarines. So we did a lot of anti-submarine training. And ironically, the ships that got out of the harbor that day were the anti-submarine destroyers. And so they started chasing the Japanese submarines away. They launched 5 of them on the eve of the attack. 1 and probably 2 got into Pearl Harbor during the attack. 1 was sunk before the attack by the USS Ward, a destroyer. 1 grounded on Bellows Field on the other side of the island the next day. And 1 disappeared, and it was found in 1960.
Oh, wow. Sunk.
While they were dredging for the big runway near the airport. They hosed it out and sent it back to Japan, where it still resides today. Well, we have a little rotating gallery here at the museum. It used to be a briefing room, but we call it the Doolittle Gallery now. In it, we're currently talking about Cornelia Fort, who was one of the flying instructors on the morning of December 7th. She was up in the air. There were actually, of the airplanes, 8 airplanes up in the air, 2 of them were piloted by women who were teaching flying to men. The one of the reasons they were in Hawaii is they couldn't get jobs on the mainland. So they came out to Hawaii, got jobs teaching, and they were up in the air early on Sunday morning, earning their pay, and both of them survived. And Cornelia Fort landed at Honolulu Airport in a rain of bullets and managed to get away. And she became one of the founding members of the Women's Air Service Pilots and was killed when a male pilot in another airplane ran into her.
Wow.
She was the first WASP killed on active duty delivering airplanes for the Army Air Forces during World War II.
These were young women. It's incredible.
She's portrayed in the movie Tora, Tora, Tora by actress Jeff Donnell, who always played the younger sister during World War II movies. But she was like 50 years old in Tora, 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 and the real Cornelia Fort was 23.
Exactly. And they had her in a biplane, correct?
Yes. And actually, it's the same kind of biplane that you see over here. But she was actually flying a high-wing monoplane at the time.
Interesting. For somebody that might want to come out to Pacific Aviation Museum, how long should they plan on spending here? What would you recommend?
We're part of what we call Pacific Historic Parks. And it's what we call in Hawaii a hui of different organizations. And there are 4 or 5 of us, and we're part of it, including the Arizona Memorial Association, the USS Missouri, the USS Utah, Memorial and the Bowfin Submarine Park. And it's almost a complete, you know, Pacific War experience. We're the museum that focuses on the attack on Pearl Harbor. So on the attack itself, we're it, but it's our reason for being here. That's why it's in our name. But we are the only major league aviation museum in the islands. And so we feel it's our duty to cover the whole reach of aviation here in the islands. From the beginning, in 1911, which is why we have a Curtiss Model D biplane hanging in the lobby, all the way up to, you know, aerospace projects today. But you can see the old Army hangars right across the field here. The field is right in the middle of the island, and it bisects the island. It's 4,000 feet long and 300 feet wide. Over here, this giant orange and white candy-striped tower is actually a water tower. You can see the elevator runs on the outside, and that's for firefighting, just in case the water mains are broken. And it was under construction at the time of the attack, and they later put a control cab on top. The original control cab at the time of the attack is a smaller building that later became a meteorological tower. Over in this direction, which you can certainly tell on radio, there are two hangars that have been completely rehabbed and a galleria built in between them. That's the current headquarters for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And they're probably the big dog on the island right now. They've got something like 600 employees. Actually, I want to read this out loud. We never had a piece of signage that explained why we're there, and so we put up one called Sacred Ground, which says, "The scarred airfield before you is a battlefield. As surely as hallowed ground at Yorktown, Gettysburg, Chateau Thierry, the beaches of Normandy, the waters of the Mekong Delta, the sands of Afghanistan, and a host of other distant places, both well-known and long forgotten. Ford Island was the epicenter of the first attack on the Pacific Fleet's base at Pearl Harbor. Here, Americans perished, as on other far-flung battlefields of past conflicts. Here, the fresh scars of conflict still mark the buildings and the pavement of what was then Naval Air Station Pearl Harbor. Oahu remains the nation's only aviation battlefield. Here, the voice of history beckons us to pause, to yield to thought and introspection, to ponder the heavy price exacted by a determined enemy." And it goes on a bit. But you shouldn't have to explain at a museum why you're there, but we consider this sacred ground.
As we're walking along here, these are aircraft tie-downs?
Yes, they are. We're walking across the tarmac now, and the buildings are pretty big. We're walking from Hangar 37 to Hangar 79.
So you have your own Air Force?
We do. Probably the largest on the island at this point. And I mean Oahu Island, not Ford Island. Outside, we have a few airplanes that are in the process of being restored. Now, you asked about visiting Pearl Harbor. There are so many attractions here now that you really need to set aside 2 days if you're going to see everything. And if you're going to Hawaii, people need to see it because it's part of the historic infrastructure of the islands. Well, we're just about to enter Hangar 79. Sticking out of the hangar is the nose of an airplane called a B-52. And, you know, I'm a museum historian and curator, and our artifacts are typical of this. This one weighs 33,000 pounds.
Just the nose?
Just the nose. And so we're always dealing with weight issues and weathering issues, and we're also in a place where we get, you know, salty sea breezes. And so ongoing destruction of the artifacts is a primary interest to us. So, but we preserve these things for future generations. Hangar 79, as we walk over here, you can see it's got banks of windows in front, but there's holes in them. And this is one of the maintenance hangars that were attacked by the Japanese on December 7th. If you look up here, there's light streaming through the bullet holes in the windows. The Navy kept them without repairing them to remind people that they're working in a combat zone. Over here, we have an F-86 and a MiG-15. This deals with the Korean War era. We're doing some modification to this exhibit right now. Behind us, this is a plane with a story, and I'll just tell you my story. This is an F-4 Phantom. This plane was the zenith of the 1950s design aesthetic for American fighters, which was very fast, carries missiles, no guns. The only enemy they thought of were Russian bombers. Our design aesthetic in the 50s was big, heavy, fast missiles, no dogfighting, no bomb capability. Vietnam comes along, and our planes are outmoded. And so they kept trying to hang guns on them and bombs on them. And the F-4 was one of those planes that did the brunt of the fighting. It was really the last of that design era. The lessons learned in Vietnam resulted in the F-14, the F-15, the F-16. Very maneuverable airplanes that can carry a variety of ordnance, but also have guns in them and can dogfight. This F-4, when it flew with the Hawaii Air National Guard, was named Pu'eo, which is Hawaiian for owl. And we have owls living here in the hangar, so much so that our restoration guys are called the hangar owls. We consider the owl here our amakua, which is an animal guiding spirit. And so it was very cool that Pu'eo was this airplane that we got. How did we take her back to Vietnam? Well, we did some research, found out she flew with the Bulldog Squadron out of Tan Sanut in Vietnam. I wanted to take her back to 1969. Flown by a guy named Fred Siebert and Pat Hayes. Pat Hayes is his rear seater. Turns out they had been killed flying a different airplane in Vietnam. Just by chance, I got a hold of Fred Siebert's widow, who had pictures of the airplane. So we were able to restore her exactly the way she looked in 1969 in Vietnam. Her name was Smoothie, and we did the best job we could. So we got her done. Then about 6 months later, a guy walks in the hangar and stops dead in his tracks and shakes all over a little bit. And I happened to be here, and I said, "Dude, what's the deal?" And he goes, "I was the crew chief on that bird in Vietnam. I never thought I'd see her again." It turned out he's a local guy. I said, "Well, how did we do?" And he said, "This is the flashback they promised us." So I'm happy that, you know, we were able to take a guy back to Vietnam in a little ways, in a good way.
In a powerful way.
In a powerful way. And reunite these guys with the airplanes that they worked on and dreamed about and to this day affect their lives. Well, we're surrounded by airplanes here. This is basically our big garage. It's got its own history. Here's an example here. All the Apollo and Gemini capsules, when they splashed down, were stored in this hangar. The capsule recovery team would go out and get them, pull them out of the ocean, bring them here and stash them for future use.
And there's the workhorse.
The UH Huey. This is another one. Got a hold of its original crew chief, and he came out here at some point and confirmed, looking at repairs he had made 50 years ago, that this was the actual bird.
Our birds here have Vietnam time on them.
This CH-46, what you call a battle frog, sits on its hind legs there, served in Vietnam and was retired from the Marine Corps only last summer.
Oh, interesting.
You looked at a big helicopter outside called a CH-53. That had Vietnam time on it as well, and that was only retired 2 years ago.
Literal workhorses.
That's the kind of helicopter that pulled all the astronauts out of the drink. In the back of the hangar, we have our restoration shop, and this is where we rebuild airplanes, either back to the way they appeared or stabilize them for as relics. For example, we have two rather large airplanes here. This is a C-47 Skytrain, which we got in pretty rocky shape, and we've taken her back to her World War II appearance, and she's awaiting now only, you know, the individual markings. We'd like to paint her in her actual markings from World War II. Behind her, we have the famous B-17 Flying Fortress.
Oh my God, where did you get that?
That came out of New Guinea, crashed in a swamp and stayed there for years, and they pulled it out. However, it's far too fragile to restore. This is the only B-17 in the world that still has its combat damage. It's, you know, full of bullet holes from its last fight as it bombed Rabaul and couldn't make it back to its base at 10-mile strip on New Guinea. So they put down up in the mountains, the Owen Stanley Mountains, in a swamp in the mountains, and was recovered about 10 years ago.
And all the crew got out?
They all got out. It took them about 3 weeks to hike through the swamps, and they all got malaria and dysentery. And you can hear the air pressure machines go in the background because our paint booth is nearby. We're in the midst of restoring a T-6 Texan.
Oh, and trainer.
It's right over here. It's in pieces right now. But we luckily found some pictures of T-6s at Wheeler Field at the time of the attack. So we're taking these trainers back to 1941. And that's John Fisher, one of our restoration guys. And he's riding a tricycle, which is one way of getting around in a big hangar.
Guys, get the right these.
Exactly. And this is relatively new. This is an F-16A, which arrived in a couple of crates. The restoration guys were a little worried about getting them together. I said, don't worry, they go together like model kits. And they had it together in like 2 days.
Very cool.
They're also working on a AH-1 Cobra, fixing up the cockpit. That's Jim Davidson, one of our restoration guys.
The windows up here that look like bullet holes, they are?
Yes.
So this hangar got attacked from all sides?
They were shooting at the airplanes that were in here, PBY Catalinas.
Do you have a PBY Catalina?
We do not.
You'd like one.
If I had a shopping list, that'd be number one on the list.
The Catalina I think it was on the drawing boards in 1934.
Yes.
Today, you see it in the sky, and it is a beautiful aircraft.
You could fly it for 24 hours practically back then. Here's our T-33. This is our other plane that was in really rocky shape, and the guys are getting her back together again. We'll put her in her Air Force markings from the 1970s. It's hard to imagine, but the 1970s are now a historic era.
Yeah.
This is the T-6 here with a nice shiny silver paint job on it.
None of these aircraft would ever be airworthy again, right?
Some of them are potentially airworthy. You can always tell the airworthy ones because they have oil dripping out of the engine. And actually, the worst-looking airplane in this hangar is the most airworthy one. It's a L-13 liaison plane. But this wreckage right here is a B-5N Kate level bomber, the kind that bombed Pearl Harbor.
Where did they find that?
They found it in a variety of different places, and it was brought here. The center section with the wings in it is in a separate part of the hangar. But this one will be restored. The thing about this wreckage is that it didn't crash. It didn't get blown up. So all the damage is caused by souvenir hunters.
Wow.
But what that means is everything that's left is still straight. Nothing's twisted. You just need to repair what's there. We don't have to build from the ground up. And this T-6 is an interesting one because it is one of 20 that were built for the Army but transferred immediately to the Navy. So it's technically both a T-6 and an SNJ. Its service was as a Navy trainer, but it had an Army serial number on it. What we have here is a F-111. We call it the Aardvark. And the wings swing back and forth. And this one's from Australia. And it's one of 11 survivors of the Australian F-111 force. They were the only country other than the United States to fly the F-111 Aardvark. This plane here, this is our only really flyable one at this point in this hangar, this old piece here. This is a very rare airplane. It's called an L-13 Grasshopper. And at the end of World War II, they took everything they learned from liaison airplanes and designed an ultimate liaison airplane. One of the things that's special about this plane is you can fold the wings back, fold the tail up, turn the wheels around, and the whole thing's no wider than a Jeep. You can tow it down the road. And yet, it can hold up to 6 people. Before World War II, the Army Air Corps, which became the Army Air Forces just on the eve of the Pearl Harbor attack, was split. They didn't know whether, you know, to focus on light aircraft that were helping the troops on the ground or strategic bombing aircraft.
So this would be an airborne forward air controller. It would be,
yes,
a classic. And
exactly.
That's why all the glass window area.
Yes, a lot of room to look out of here. Here's our only overtly civilian airplane that's in this hangar. This is a Republic CB. And during World War II, Republic Aircraft, which was known for building big, heavy, you know, ironworks type of airplanes, thought there'd be a big market after the war for, you know, pilots coming back and wanting their own aircraft. So they designed a little seaplane, and then they kept refining it until it only has like 400 parts. There's only 400 parts to this whole airplane.
Amazing.
They built about 1,200 of them, and it was actually one of the more successful post-war designs, but they only built 1,200 of them, and about a quarter of those are still flying today. And as I went through my father's logbook when we were stationed in Alaska back in the 50s, I discovered he had flown this actual airplane when it was up in Alaska. People come in and they see these airplanes, and for many people they're like, you know, dreams come true. Yeah, everyone dreams about flying. And we're living in an age that they'll be talking about 1,000 years from now. This is the age in which man first left the earth. Just a little over a century ago, we went from a two-dimensional living to a three-dimensional living. We left the earth. We got to look down on the earth. And we started to look at the earth in a holistic sense. And that's what aviation has done for us. It's not just a matter of getting from here to there quicker and in a straight line. It's a matter of philosophy. We are going to be critically short of airline pilots in about 10 or 15 years. The masses of pilots that were being trained in the military just don't exist anymore. And a lot of these pilots that are coming out of the military are women. Probably about a quarter of them are women now.
Very cool. With your life here at the Pacific Aviation Museum, tell us about some of the fascinating interactions with women and kids and people who have no relationship with military.
You know, aviation, you know, has to do not just with the philosophy, but science and technology and knowledge and, you know, just the idea of being able to reach for something that's beyond your grasp. And that's an important lesson for everyone. women and girls have been shortchanged in that a lot. And we've actually developed educational programs. Our big summer one is called Flight School for Girls, where middle school girls come and they basically spend a week here learning, you know, STEM and STEAM things, science, technology, engineering, math, and how to apply that to aviation. And it turns out aviation works on all those levels. See, aviation is one of those things that's technical, but at the same time, it's very inspiring and dreamlike.
We've been visiting with historian Burl Burlingame and Kenneth DeHoff, the executive director at the Pacific Aviation Museum Pearl Harbor on Ford Island, Hawaii. The underbed music was performed by the United States Air Force Tactical Command Band.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdell, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez. Melissa Corbin reporting, Tennessee. Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada. Kim Schneider from Michigan. Elaine Masters in San Diego. Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon. Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas. And Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR. Thank you.